Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation on the web at www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I can feel you like an ocean that won't seem to let me go.
Welcome to Signs of Life Radio. I'm Kimberly Saavedra, Director of the Kamala Center in California. I, along with Dr. Betty Kovach, author of The Miracle of Death and her forthcoming publication, The Merchants of Light, Frequencies of a New Consciousness, have the distinct pleasure of co-hosting today's show. Before we introduce today's guest, we'd like to thank the sponsor, the Windbridge Institute, which is an independent research organization investigating capabilities of our bodies, minds, and spirits. Please visit www.windbridge.org to learn about their research projects and findings. Also, Forever Family Foundation's 6th Annual Grief Transformation Retreat will take place in Chester, Connecticut on Friday, July 14th to Sunday, July 16th. For more information, please visit www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Our guest today, Lisa Smart, M.A., is the author of Words at the Threshold, What We Say as We're Nearing Death. A linguist, educator, and poet, she founded the Final Words Project, an ongoing study devoted to collecting and interpreting the mysterious language at the end of lives. She co-facilitates workshops about language and consciousness with Raymond Moody at universities, hospices, and conferences.
Yes. Hi, Lisa. This is Betty. And I want to, first of all, thank you for your work and congratulate you that you've done it. I think that this type of work is so important for our time when we are, through near-death experiences and visions and dreams, beginning to understand that death is something quite different from what our culture had taught us to think it is. So I'm very, very grateful for this work, and I enjoyed reading it very much. I was thinking as I was reading it that a friend of mine said a few days ago that an acquaintance of hers told her that the doctor had just told him that at best he had 2 years to live. Mm. And then she said, but I didn't ask him anything else because I felt it was inappropriate. Mm. And I think that we're learning that it's very appropriate to talk with people who are dying, even if it's 2 years before the death. But you talk particularly about the dying when they're right at that threshold of crossing over. And I'm just very grateful to you because you teach us not only that it is appropriate to be present and talk and listen, but you teach us how to do it. So I would like to know actually how you got involved in this. How did you even want to study this?
Oh, great. Well, thank you. First of all, I want to say I'm honored that you feel that my book has that kind, brings those kinds of tools to people, because I think they're so important. And of course, that was my intention in writing the book, and I'm delighted that you received it that way. So thank you. I started writing the book. I was someone who was very afraid of the topic of death and dying. I had never in a million years thought that I would be speaking with others about it. And until my background was in linguistics, I studied language and worked with people who had difficulty with language and processing language. And then my father very suddenly entered the dying phase. He had prostate cancer. The prognosis was good. We didn't expect him to die so quickly, but within a 3-week period, he passed on, and I was bedside with him while that happened. And as he was dying, I noticed a number of changes, both in his expression of what he perceived and also in the words he spoke. My dad was a hardcore skeptic. He was a man who he had a PhD, was very intellectual, And I've always been more open-minded to the possibility of something beyond and the survival of consciousness. I was more curious and open-minded, but my father would roll his eyes anytime I spoke about anything. And he used to call himself a gastronomical Jew. For him, that meant his idea of God was a corned beef sandwich and, coleslaw on the side kind of thing. So he was a very, very down-to-earth person. So about 2.5 weeks before he died, he started talking about angels in the room, which stunned me. And then I noticed other things, not only in his perception, but the kinds of language that emerged in terms of more metaphors, more not types of nonsense. A really fascinating shift. And I began to write them all down because I was trained as a linguist to write things down when I heard them if they baffled me and made me curious. And then 3 days before he died, he announced, "Enough, enough. The angels say enough." Only 3 days left.
Just pause here for a minute, Lisa.
Yes.
That's incredible, isn't it? I mean, I think in the book you said he graduated from MIT.
He didn't have that illustrious and academic background, but he did have a PhD, and he was someone who believed that the world was completely material, right? So to hear him speak about angels 3 days before he died, and indeed, he did die 3 days later, was just stunning to me.
Well, it's stunning to us, too. I mean, for such a scientific mind to see the angels as he is crossing over is just remarkable. And now, please continue.
Yes, no, and so after I witnessed, first, I witnessed these kinds of changes in perception, which I'd never expected to see in my father. And also there was the language that I began to look at after he passed and started to see that there was language I had never heard when he was living and healthy, certain types of nonsense, paradoxical language, a lot of repetition and so forth. He began to speak differently about his placement in space. So his use of prepositions, he was talking about moving upward and over and things he, of course, I had never heard from when he was healthier. So right after he passed, I went back to UC Berkeley, where I went to school, and went to the linguistics library and began to look in the database, thinking that there must have been a lot of research already in the language of those at end of life, because what I saw was so stunning to me, and I wanted to see what had already been done in terms of the research, and there was just about nothing. The only thing I saw was research on how doctors could speak to patients, in terms of ways to communicate certain diagnoses and, prognosis and how to speak about death, but nothing really about the language of those at the threshold. And when I saw that there was nothing about that, I it was almost as if I became possessed by curiosity. And then for 4 or 5 years, I pursued final words, and that included very gratefully working with Raymond Moody.
How did you start working with him? How did your paths cross?
It was a series of synchronicities. From the beginning, this whole project has been, for lack of a better word, blessed with a kind of just a number of synchronicities. So at that time, after I found out that there was so little written about final words, I began to read everything I could. I read Callanan and Kelly, their great book, Final Gifts. I read Austin and Haraldson. Am I saying their name correctly? I should know how to say that. David Kessler. I read everybody I could. And among the people I read was Raymond Moody, who I read when I was 17. And I reread his books. And synchronistically, about 2 weeks after that, a friend of my mother's let us know that he was co-teaching with Raymond in Alabama.
That is synchronistic.
That's synchronistic. I mean, what are the chances? And then, I've always been, my background is you know, as an educator and working as a nonprofit, so I never have a whole lot of money in the bank. And so it was $2,000 to get out there, and I wasn't sure I could afford it. And a couple days later, my tax refund came for just the
amount. Oh, that sounds like us.
Does it sound familiar? Isn't it amazing
yes.
that those things happen? And when, you know, and I did, I sort of took it as a sign from the universe to go ahead and go for it. And so I spent, it was a five-day seminar. It was remarkable. And Raymond was very humble and very accessible, and there were only 15 of us at that workshop. And the fourth day, he began to speak about his research into nonsense and unintelligibility. And apparently, Raymond, his first degree was actually a PhD in philosophy, and his love was nonsense. You know,
for heaven's sake.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah.
It is amazing.
So I was stunned when I heard that because, of course, my background was in linguistics. And it was actually his interest in nonsense that brought him to the near-death experience. And he began to explain how, as a philosophy student, he, as I said, loved, for example, Alice in Wonderland, and was curious because he was convinced at this time and still is that while we are often afraid of nonsense many times when we hear it, we also seem to have a attraction or desire for it. So he came to the near-death experience because after he completed his PhD in philosophy and became a medical student, when people would die and come back, the stories that they shared sounded like nonsense in terms of what we knew about the world.
Yes, and that's really the point, isn't it, that it so much of it seemed like nonsense because we didn't have any sense of another world.
Exactly, and, you know, a lot of times the things that we hear that sound like nonsense are only because of the context we have. So that we don't more fully understand them. So what Raymond found at this time when he was a medical student and heard from his patients who had cardiac arrests or so forth and came back to life, were things, he heard things like, I never felt as alive as when I was dead, right? which, you know, right, that sounds like Alice in Wonderland. It's that kind of whimsical nonsense. Or, well, you know, when we say nonsense, we don't do it in a negative way. We're just doing it descriptively. So as he wrote down people's nonsensical accounts, actually patterns began to emerge, you know, the pattern of the tunnel and the pattern of seeing certain kinds of, you know, it felt like I was gone for a minute, but also an eternity, right? These kinds of paradoxical. So anyway, he started talking about that in language, and then I started speaking about some of the paradoxical language I heard from my father and the kinds of things that baffled me in my father's language. And I asked, is there any way I could study with you? And he said, yes. And I went back home and retired early. And
oh, that's so amazing.
That's a leap of faith.
That was your destiny, wasn't it?
Well, you know, it is so true about those leaps of faith. You know, there are just those moments. This was the first time in my life I'd ever felt it so clearly that there seemed in my heart to be no choice. I just knew that I had to do this work, and I feel very fortunate that that I was, I don't know, called, or that I'm the person who has begun or at least be opened up this conversation. Now, again, there are other people, of course, who preceded me who opened the door, but I've been able to walk through in terms of specifically with linguistics.
Well, we really are living in a time when quite a few people are opening their hearts and minds to so much that was repressed, denied, rejected, before because of our worldview, and I think you mentioned that in the book. And it's just wonderful to, I mean, here you were a linguist, so you were so excited when you started seeing patterns, and then through the heart, through an experience of death of someone you love, you were able to enter that work. So I think that there's several people working and just discovering incredible things about who we are, why we're here, what our potentials are, and other dimensional worlds.
Yes, I completely agree. And what I love about language and, you know, whatever small way that this work may contribute, and I think it's just begun. This is a small sample, small state, you know, relatively small, and it's growing as I'm doing these interviews and people are sharing more accounts. But, you know, in my small little, this little part of the universe that I'm in with language, what's remarkable is when you collect the kind of data that you can with through language, there's no way of disputing the existence of these kinds of experiences and shifts that we see at the threshold.
Mm-hmm. And that all of that collecting is a part of the Final Words Project?
Yes, thank you for asking. Yes, it is. So we have a website. When I say we, Raymond is working still with me closely on this project. And we have a website where we collect accounts and ask people lots of information, and it's confidential. And so we have that. And then also I've done it through social media. It's such an amazing tool these days in terms of connecting.
Yeah, it is.
And then I did a lot of interviews with healthcare professionals, and especially at hospice, and people were very generous to share accounts, again, confidentially, you know, with no identifying information in those cases. So it's been wonderful. I think now, because I've been able to gather much more data, it's all been in Canada and the United States. So far English, so I'm beginning to get some samples from other languages, which is the most exciting thing. I think we're up to about 2,000 final words, or what I call utterances. So it's great. The data is growing, and more patterns are emerging. And one of the things that's been hardest to get, the data that was hardest, is really those sentences that are truly nonsensical. Something like, yes, I would like some scrambled eggs, but where would you reappear? Now, something like that, you know, versus something like, oh, it's my husband Earl, which might seem like nonsense because we don't see Earl. Like, let's say, you know, there's certain what I call situational nonsense. But then there's linguistic nonsense, which just it's hard to wrap your mind around. Like, yes, I would like some scrambled eggs, but where would you reappear? You know, something that's very hard to make sense of. And a lot of the straight, really nonsensical phrases were hard to get because people just completely discount them. Raymond says there's a nonsense taboo. Like, we really have a hard time when we hear complete word salad to take it seriously. So we're hoping people will bring us more and more of that kind of nonsense. Mm-hmm. The other kind of nonsense is when someone says, there's a big forest in my room, or I see an angel. You know, the kind of nonsense when we don't see something, we go, oh, that's nonsense. There's no angels here. Right, so there's situational, right, there's no. But so there's the nonsense of what's the unseen, but then there's the linguistic nonsense, which is just we can't even make sense of it. And we really want to study both forms of nonsense, and hoping we get more and more of the kind of, let me think of another one, like the doll is doing a roofing, right? Something that you just think, what is, that makes no sense. Versus, oh, here's my husband, he's come to take me home, right, where that's nonsense in terms of what we know about the world, or you know, this world, but we can make sense in terms of the language. So, you know, we've just begun, and we're hoping to get more and more data, but the data's growing, and in the patterns we found, it's completely remarkable the kinds of patterns we're finding.
Lisa, you kind of touched on something a moment ago that reminded me to ask you to share, please, if you wouldn't mind, some of the tools for the more meaningful communications that can be had with loved ones who are at the end of life. You really set out some helpful suggestions to
that was excellent. Yeah.
Loved ones.
Thank you. I think the first is really to enter the world of the person dying, and one way is to write down their words while you're there, because it really helps to kind of focus in. And so the first is to enter the world of the person dying, and if you feel comfortable, keep a final words journal. And then I'd say have
that way you can see patterns, I guess, right? After
yes, you can see your own patterns, and sometimes you may write something down at the time, it's almost like for those of us who have kept dream journals, you know, sometimes you may have a dream and at the time you just think this makes no sense whatsoever.
Yeah, and
then you write it down, and then either through writing it down it makes sense, or maybe a month later you'll look back and go, oh my goodness, those are the, you know, those symbols or some, and there's something just about the process. You know, it's possible that your loved one's words will not ever make sense, but there's something about writing the words down that I think helps kind of enter into to your loved one's reality. And
I absolutely agree with that, because in writing dreams, so often I will be, there's a consciousness that comes with the actual writing of it. You know, then you start seeing connections and patterns that you wouldn't have seen if you just think about it.
Yes, no, exactly. I'm so glad that that's been your experience also, because it was very much, and I think that's why, you know, I had an experience with my father that was very intimate and close and dear, and I think part of it was because I was writing down his words, and I've heard from many other people now that have been involved, because I've asked people to do their own transcriptions. Like, I didn't walk in there with a tape recorder, but people wrote down their transcriptions for the Final Words Project, and many people had the same experience, that there was something very healing about it for them. Sometimes it was disturbing because the language was baffling, but for many, and I've also heard from people, you know, weeks later things made sense. Right, or after the person died, or there might have even been precognitive information in some of the things their loved one said that didn't make sense at the time. So that's my first piece. The other thing I really suggest is to have eyes for the sacred. Because many times when we'll hear some of this, the language that's puzzling, and hear things that at the time don't make sense, it's really, you know, losing someone we love is scary. And sometimes the changes we see physically that's going on in their bodies is scary. And for me, I've come to really feel that the more we can hold this transition as sacred, the more it actually becomes sacred.
Mm-hmm.
And validate the person's words. People may say things that are nonsensical, and just enter into the reality, you know, almost as we would with children.
Mm-hmm,
you know, when we
have
kids, right? It's sort of the same thing. So if someone starts talking about, I need to find my passport because I'm stuck between two countries, and that one was shared with me by a wonderful chaplain I interviewed, then you don't say, what are you talking about, you know?
That's not true.
Of course, you know, you offer to help to find the passport or validate the reality. And just ask questions. I mean, one of the things I regret is when my father was dying, he said, I wish I had asked him more about the angels.
Yes.
You know, I was so stunned by him saying that. I was busy writing it down.
You're probably in shock. Huh?
I was in shock. I was so surprised. And now I wish I said, oh, my gosh, Papa, what kind of angels do you see? You know, I wish I had engaged him more. Oh, you need a passport. Tell me about your passport. Or, you know, any of those. And you know, people should, what I've heard from hospice providers is really assume that your loved ones can hear you even if they're unresponsive.
I think that's very important, that what you're doing, just the energy of capturing their words and being present, must create a circular path of that energy that they know about and can feel, as well as hear.
I think that's
really
good.
I didn't know that the sense of hearing is the last to go, and I learned that from your book.
Oh yeah, I'm glad because I think that's what I heard from hospice care workers. And so with my father, and then I found out later with other people that, you know, I was told, when you're in the other room, be as generous in your praise of your father as possible. And the nurses told me yes, people really can hear. And Madeline Lawrence, who did research into coma survivors, talked a lot about how people in coma, 70% of people that she had in her study said that they remembered events while they were in comas, and much of that, of course, was information they heard.
Yes, I've read a lot about that, and yet so many doctors don't understand that. They come in and say dreadful things, you know, about the condition of the patient. In my own case, when my son was in a coma, the doctor came in and he said, I want to test him to see if he's not brain dead, if he's blind or not.
Oh my God.
And I kind of took him by the hand and we went outside and I said, you know, we don't know whether he can hear or not, but it's probably better to be careful and assume he can. That would be a terrible thing to hear.
Good for you. I mean, good for you, yes, because Madeline Lawrence, she had these stories of a couple people who talked about, they overheard healthcare professionals saying, oh, they're just a vegetable, right? And the person said, as they heard that, they were, this one woman was like outraged because I'm not a vegetable.
That's amazing. It's amazing that, well, certainly, and I'm hoping that your book gets to people working in hospice. And I'm sure it will because you interviewed so many people there. But I've heard that sometimes hospice centers are not as open to this sort of thing. What was your experience with that?
You know, I really found a wide range. When I first started, most hospices were very protective, which they should be, about anyone coming in and doing research. Which is the correct thing. And at the same time, how else are we going to have these conversations if the doors don't crack open a little bit? But I learned from hospice about how important it is to maintain the sanctity and the sacred quality of end of life, and I'm very grateful for that. And at the same time, some were more open to others and engaging and really active conversations. And the hospices where people were open were amazing. I was so impressed and touched by the quality of people and commitment to their work in so many of the hospices. But there was quite a range in how open people were
Well, that's good. That's wonderful. You also spoke of, that's probably your next point, the silence, how to live in the silence of the patient.
Yes, and one of the things that surprised me, and I didn't expect it at all to go in this direction in my research, but it emerged so authentically, is people explain, several nurses shared with me that they had almost telepathic communications with their patients, that they really got attuned. And this was from people who were highly trained in science. One is from a very well-known, reputable hospital. They're not woo-woo, right? These are people who are very grounded, scientific people who had these experiences with their patients at the end of life of communicating telepathically, like really hearing from patients, I only have 2 days left and so forth, and I need this. It was very powerful, and family members shared this with me, that they felt that when they could just sit as if in prayer and meditation, many of them began to feel like they were in tune with their loved ones. And yet when you think about it, many of us with our children had this experience, you know, before they began speaking, that and when we really open our hearts to others and imagine the possibility that communication can take place without words, it can actually happen, right? We can actually kind of...
Absolutely. Yes, and that's why I also agree that just being present in the room, I mean, if we can communicate telepathically, they can know what we're doing and that we're there, what we're doing.
No, this was something that I became very convinced about as I did this research. There's one story from Terry Daniel who does the, she's with an organization that's sort of similar to yours, but she talked about how her son had this degenerative disease, and as he lost language, her psychic abilities increased. So he was... I think he was a teenager, and he had this terrible disease, and as he lost his capabilities physically and communicatively, she became more and more telepathic, and it was through that experience that she became really involved in psychic work and so forth. And so that's so fascinating to me, that we saw that, and I heard of other cases of mothers and children having those kinds of connections. And
you know, I'm having difficulty hearing you.
Oh,
I think.
Oh no! Oh no!
I know. Can you just go over that last again?
Yes. How much of it? Should I start from the beginning? Do you think?
No, just where you were.
You were introducing the story, Terry Daniels.
Yes.
Yeah, Terry Daniel was someone I interviewed for the book, and she was a mother whose son had a terrible degenerative disease, and as he was losing more and more physical capability, including the ability to speak, she became more and more psychic, as has happened, and felt that her communication with him became completely telepathic before he died because he lost the ability to speak.
Mm,
so it's such a powerful story. And I heard similar stories not only from a handful of healthcare professionals, but also from family members who, even though their loved one had lost language, there was still a sense of connection. And this happened with those who were unafraid, you know, who could take a deep breath and almost imagine as if they were in prayer and meditation with their loved one, even though they may not be responsive at the time. And we also know with many people who are unresponsive, often there's this window they call terminal lucidity, that even though people may be completely unresponsive, many times right before they die, there may be some kind of either communication with their hands or so forth, or actually with their words.
Mm-hmm.
And something that might be like, tell everyone I love them and I'm okay. You know, they might remarkable stories. Someone just sent me a story yesterday and said their loved one was in a coma, completely unresponsive, and right before dying, and this person was not a very spiritual or religious person, right before they passed, said, right before he or she passed, said, life is a benediction.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah,
I thought that was
so
remarkable. It was one of the most beautiful things I'd heard in the research.
Well, this is really, this whole process does so many things, but it certainly opens us to such a much vaster dimension of our own consciousness and what we're capable of, doesn't it?
It really does. And I think the biggest gift for me in this work is that, for me, it redefined language. Right, most of us think language is that thing, you know, could you please hand me that cup of tea, right? Language is something that functions in a very literal point A to point B way. Now, I love poetry, so I know that metaphor and symbol is also part of language. However, by studying the words at the threshold, suddenly my whole idea of what communication is expanded in a way I had not at all expected. And I would have never thought that sitting at the bedside of someone I love in a kind of meditative state, I would have never thought that that would have been part of my idea of communication. And then when I started interviewing people and I heard an abundance of stories, and again from people that I considered very grounded, very, you know, just like my father, you know, rationally oriented people sharing their after-death communication stories with me, then, of course, as a linguist, my definition of language expanded even beyond boundaries I had not expected.
Yes. Well, you know, when I was reading your book, I kept thinking of one of the first major theorists of symbolic language, Jean-Baptiste Vico,
mm-hmm.
and how he saw, even in the 1700s, he saw that the wholeness of the mind required an integral and dynamic continuum of movement between symbolic, mythic, feeling language, and conceptual language. And I love that, because we in our culture simply cut off and disregarded and discredited the symbolic, mythic, feeling language that the Sufis would call the language of soul, which you are saying too. And Vico makes it very clear that the symbol has a poetic logic, and it gives birth to conceptual logic, which comes later. So it would really tie in with what you're saying, that in the beginning of our species, we developed the right brain first, the symbolic logic first, and then later we develop conceptual logic as we get older. But that would be the first to go, and we would go back into our, what I always like to call our native language, the language of symbol and myth and feeling. And I was just so pleased to see that your work
kind of validated Vico.
Oh, I love the way you articulated that is so in keeping with my experience in the data, and thank you, so beautifully articulated. And it does seem that way. You were talking about kind of the reverting back to a certain symbolic language, or at least that continuum, and that was very much my experience. And symbolic language, as I mentioned in the book, many of the psychics that I spoke to and mediums shared with me, and even one medium, William Stillman, who is also, he has Asperger's and he's worked with people with autism himself, that for him there is this, he calls it a spiritual iconography. When he does psychic readings, and also as someone who has had Asperger's, his experience of language is highly symbolic, and that he sees pictures. And several psychics, including him, said sometimes the most accurate psychic information came in symbols and pictures that were kind of nonsensical. You know, for example, when he gets a picture of an oven with one burner kind of low, for him, that symbolizes someone might have Alzheimer's. Well, that's just a nonsensical symbol, right? You know, the oven with the low burner and so forth. So he said he has his own symbolic language that he's learned to interpret when he does psychic readings. And that's so fascinating, right? Because
Jewish and Christian spiritual traditions made it very clear, that particular aspect became rather undergrounded, but they made it very clear that the language of the subtle world is symbolic, that's the way we communicate with that other world, and it makes good sense. And I think it's kind of interesting, I was interested in your saying that in the book, that this particular person said, well, we have our own. I think we do, you know, we pick it up in different ways and adjust it and arrange it, but we know, the key to that language.
Yes, and, you know, often, again, going back to dreams, you know, I may dream of an apple, and it means one thing, and you may dream of an apple, and it may mean something else, and what's important. And that's the difference between literal language, because when I say cup,
absolutely,
right? And the other thing that's fascinating to me in terms of synchronicities in life, because I know in my own life, you know, when we talked about the Final Words Project and the synchronicities that occurred in my life with it, that what seems to happen, too, is we have certain symbolic synchronicities, or someone may lose a loved one and then a bird comes to their window every single day or something like that, and then there's a symbol, right? So that same kind of symbolic reality that you had mentioned, that you talked about, that has those mythic qualities, seems to be very closely connected to the language of spirit or soul, as you had mentioned. I agree with you.
I do. Lisa, could you talk some about shared death experiences?
Oh, yeah, we love
and
that.
Yours with your father at the 3:15 a.m. moment?
That was wonderful.
Are pretty rich.
Yes, they're very rich, and they are. And my greatest teachers about those, David Kessler writes about it, and of course, Raymond Moody in his book, Glimpses of Eternity. And finally, I just want to give a shout-out to William Peters, who's doing beautiful work in Santa Barbara at Shared Crossings, where he's guiding family members to be more open to the possibility of shared death experiences. So in my case, what happened, I'm forgetting now, it was a little over a week before my father passed. I mean, a little before he passed, about 8 days, I think, before he passed. But I woke up in the middle of the night, about 3:15, and you know how it is when you feel people in a room with you? You know, if you're standing somewhere and the lights are out, you could feel that there are other people with you. There's, like, the sense of presence or weight in the room. So I woke up at 3:15, and I felt like a weight, you know, like weight in the room. And then I looked up, and it was almost like it was swirling or something. And as I felt that, I looked at the clock, and it was in red, you know, 3:15. And I woke up my husband, and I said, this is weird. It feels almost heavy in here or something. And my dear husband was like, yeah, yeah. Get back to sleep. And then I said, I wonder if my father is dying now. I wonder if something's going on now. And he said, go back to sleep. Your mother will let you know, and so forth. So a few minutes later, I forgot. Actually, I'm embarrassed to say, I think it was 3:26, finally, when I got back to sleep. I think I write about it in the book. I can't remember. That's embarrassing. But I think it was at 3:26. I looked at the clock and went back to sleep. The next day, I went to visit, as I always did. My parents lived about an hour away from me, where I was working. So I went, I said to my mom, hey, how's Papa? She said, well, he's fine, but the strangest thing happened at 3:15. He woke up and started talking about how crowded the room was.
Oh, and that's so amazing.
Isn't it amazing? And then he said, he didn't have time to talk to all these people.
Gosh. Mm. Oh, my goodness.
That was good.
You know, Lisa, I think with your project, as you continue it, you're going to have so many interesting experiences recorded like that. And we need to know those, don't we? You're probably going to be writing a record of those experiences later on.
Yes, and I think so. And then what's so exciting is that there are other people, such as William Peters and Raymond Moody also had done it, who are, or alongside my work with language, are documenting these accounts as well. Martha Jo Atkins, you know, there are many people. So it's such a joy to be in this field with other people who are doing parallel kinds of research, and we're seeing, we're getting almost a fuller view as we're working together in our own, you know, respective areas. So, yes, yeah, very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there were so many different themes in the repetition, and I love the one about the unity, the two holes, and I need you to get the two holes, need to put them together to make one. It's all one piece, it's all one. What you see in two different pieces, it's all in one piece, and they're just, I think they're just really seeing some magnificence laid out that was definitely not clear from this limited perspective.
Yeah, I agree, and I hear, and this woman, I won't say much because of confidentiality, but she told me that her husband was an FBI, he was in the FBI, and not the kind of person who was inclined to talk that way. He was not the kind of person to talk that way. I mean, she said it was so uncharacteristic of him, and this whole thing of unity and two things becoming one emerges a fair amount in the transcripts, and as you mentioned, repetition is much more common in the language of the threshold than it is in day-to-day life. You know, many of us know about Steve Jobs' final words, oh, wow.
Yeah, this work is actually changing the way we understand our own consciousness and the cosmos, and it's happening on so many different levels. I think we really are shifting. We're going through a tremendous transformation in spite of what it looks like on the surface of our cultures. I think the tremendously powerful seeds of light and awareness are being planted by this kind of work.
I agree, and I know just my own life has been illuminated by doing this work.
Yeah.
And if one person, little old me, you know, looking at this data, can feel such a change in my feelings about death and about life, you know, my sense of spirituality has so deepened. And I would say, you know, even though I lost my father, I am in many ways an expanded and happier person today than I was 5 years ago.
Yes.
So
we hear so many people say that, and I myself can say that. The deaths in my family expanded my own consciousness and of my husband. I had been working in that field for some time, but I was totally transformed. And my husband was a businessman, tolerant but not too interested in it, and he totally changed. So I think our confrontation with death brings us a consciousness that we need and that the world needs today.
Yes, I think so. And you know, it does two things at once. On one hand, by looking at death and facing death and acknowledging its reality, we acknowledge the limitations of this life, and for me, makes me really just love. I'm a kinder person because I've acknowledged to myself that we all are going to die. I'm a more thoughtful person. I'm a more grateful person. And at the same time, by studying this work, there's a way that I believe life goes on in a way. So it's kind of a paradox. And, you know, on one hand, I believe consciousness does, or I believe more than I ever have, that consciousness does survive. And at the same time, I'm very clear that at least Lisa in my body, with my life circumstances, is going to end. It is going to end.
But if our consciousness does survive, then all that you have learned and become as Lisa does survive.
Yes.
If our consciousness survives, right?
Right.
It's
Yes, and that's why, you know, the final words to me are so exciting, because it's almost like you can follow, the words are like tracks in the sand you can follow as people pass on. And it's a very, and those tracks can sometimes even go beyond the threshold, because several people who took transcriptions as part of the Final Words Project reported to me afterwards they had experiences of automatic writing or other synchronicities that really made them feel that they were connected with the spirit of their loved one.
Well, I think so many things have happened in the 20th century and now in the 21st that give us, some people are reluctant to call it evidence, but it seems from the experiential perspective, it definitely is evidence that another dimension of reality exists and that we can experience it. And in fact, that it is our heritage to experience that, to be connected to that world. And we can connect most powerfully sometimes through death. I loved how you said the quotation, "The words at the threshold suggest to me that consciousness does indeed survive, and that we ourselves can be both guides and tourists as we journey with those we love to the portal." So yes, we can both guide the dying and learn ourselves and experience ourselves something about that other world and the process.
Yes. Because, you know, we are, at least as far as we know, the people we are in this lifetime, we are completely new to that territory. You know, I mean, for me, I had never really been so close to anyone bedside until my father died. And I am a tourist to the threshold, right, as long as I'm alive and I haven't, at least in this lifetime, transitioned, right? But at the same time, we're called upon to be guides when someone we love is dying. So it is a dual role, and it's one that we don't have that often in life. So that's part of the challenge. And everything associated with the threshold is paradoxical. You know, and Raymond talks about this. There's this very paradoxical quality to end of life, you know, being the tourist and the guide.
Yes.
You know, and it's a fascinating quality, and this is something Raymond really taught me, is that nonsense, one of the characteristics of nonsense often is it's paradoxical, and that seems to be one of the qualities of end of life.
Yes, that it's both this and that, as they say about the mystic experience. You know, it's not, there's not just light and dark, but the light is the dark. The dark is the light, and that kind of strange paradoxical way that we can't quite understand with our rational minds.
Beautiful. Yes. Yes.
Lisa, do you remember the story of Jack the vaudeville magician?
I do. As a matter of fact, I
love that story, and I was hoping we'd have a chance to share. It's just so unusual.
It is, and this was actually in Doug C. Smith's book, Caregiving.
Right.
And do you want me to read it? Do we have time for me to read it?
Sure, it's on page 43. I printed it, too. I was hoping you would. It begins on 43.
I got it here. Thank you. Thank you for asking, too. So, in another story, Doug C. Smith, a hospice director in West Virginia, talked about the patient Jack, a retired vaudeville magician. As I stood in the doorway of his hospital room, I saw Jack propped upright, surrounded by pillows. He smiled and said, "Doug, we've all been waiting for you to arrive." I wondered who we were because he was the only person in the room. I walked in, smiled at him, and thought this might not be such a difficult visit after all. Today is your initiation day, Doug. Today you will become a member of the Royal Society of Magicians, Jack said. This was going to be a fun visit, I thought, and I wanted to participate in his fun. But Jack then looked away from me, and his expression seemed glassy-eyed. He spoke several nonsensical sentences, sounding both like a magical incantation and a speaking in tongues. He abruptly broke off his nonsensical language and looked directly at me. Come closer, he said in a serious tone. You will learn a great magic trick today, the very greatest trick of all. His voice was weak but determined. Come closer. I felt that I was already near enough to hear whatever he was about to do or say, but I leaned in over his bed. Come closer, he repeated. I began to feel uncomfortable, but I leaned in until we were eye to eye with no more than 6 inches between our faces. Jack seemed to be looking straight through me. His eyes were searching for something in my eyes. Without any change in his facial expression, Jack whispered, "Watch me disappear." His eyes took on a glassy, frozen appearance. I knew instantly that Jack died in the moment he whispered those words.
God. That is incredible.
It is.
You read it so beautifully.
Thank
Lisa.
You for reading it.
Oh, yes, that's incredible.
I really love that one. Just is no limit to the creativity. And
right.
He, as you had said about many of the patients, incorporated aspects of his life into his time and words and experiences at his transition.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you're about to sign off, and I just want to say, Lisa, in the few seconds I have here, just congratulations and thank you for the work, and hopefully our paths will cross again, and I wish you just so much success in getting this book into the hands of those who need to read it and want to read it.
Oh, thank you,
Lisa, do you want in our sign-off a moment to say anything about what's next for you and where our listeners may keep in touch and learn more about?
Yes. Come to www.finalwordsproject.org. We are still collecting stories and final words, and we are inviting people to even share those nonsensical phrases or things people think are nonsense, because those are really precious for us. And we're beginning to do cross-linguistic. So if you have heard final words in another language or you know people in another country who might want to be involved, we want to start seeing if there are parallels between the experiences and people in other cultures and languages.
Yeah, that's going to be very interesting.
Very interesting. Thank you, Lisa. We really enjoyed talking with you. And thank you so much to our Signs of Life audience. Remember to visit www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org to find out more about the Grief Transformation Retreat in July. And thank you once again to our fabulous sponsor, the Windbridge Institute. Take care, be well, and we'll look forward to being with you again.